Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're going to take a very interesting look at the early exploration of blood transfusions in 17th century, basically London and Paris, and see what this might tell us a little bit about ourselves, science, and our current culture. Our guest is Holly Tucker. She's the author of the book Blood Work, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. Dr. Tucker is an associate professor in the Department of French and Italian at the Center of Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University. Her research interests are 17th and 18th century medicine and culture. If you have questions or comments during today's program, you can reach us directly at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Tucker, it's a real pleasure to have you joining us. Thanks very much for taking the time today.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I guess, thank goodness for interdisciplinary studies and programs at universities, or we wouldn't maybe have this book.
Absolutely. In fact, I just marvel at the idea that someone who works in the humanities could be talking to physicians, can be talking to ethicists. And if we didn't have interdisciplinarity and we didn't support humanistic research, we wouldn't be here.
It's the book reads as if you were a professionally trained historian, and the information and data is just so well researched. But I guess your background and interest in writing and in France and French and actually living in France at times is given you, as well as your studies, have given you plenty of opportunity to learn how to research like a historian.
Right, and I think I identify mostly as a humanist in the sense that to do graduate-level work in French studies, for example, is very much similar to doing graduate-level work as an English professor, and you really can't look at the cultural documents of the past with, of course, not evoking the past. And so much of what I wanted to do in this book as a researcher is to be able to launch myself back in time and to imagine what it would have been like to walk the streets of Paris and London in the 17th century, is to think about what they would sound like, what they would look like, maybe not so much what they smell like, because those streets were stinky. And in writing this, I wanted to bring readers along with me for the ride so that we could explore it together.
Well, let's do that. Let's kind of flesh out the smells and odors and excitement of this time, if you don't mind. And I would maybe start by just having read recently or heard on a podcast about the history of the stethoscope, where it was invented found by Laennec. And I guess his interest in the comments I heard was he didn't want to put his head on people's chests anymore because of the smell and the fact that he got lice from people. So tell us about what it was like at the time of the story, the book, the research that was going on in Paris and in London.
Well, it set the stage a bit for these medical experiments that were being done animals and later humans. You know, this is before anesthesia, before antisepsis, before they 17th century Paris, there was only one sewer, and that was near the Louvre, and it was a brand new idea. So the idea of public health, the idea that you would actually want to shower and you want to watch out for germs, I mean, this is long before germ theory was absent. So it is a bumbling mess of dirt and grime and smell and illness. In fact, John Evelyn in 17th century London said that it was sometimes very hard to go to church, to go to listen to Mass, because there was so much hacking and wheezing and coughing about. So it's not a place. I've always wondered if I'd want to get into a time machine and be catapulted back into, 1667. As much as I like to imagine it, I think daily life would be extraordinarily difficult.
What was the concept of health and disease? What were What was going on? What caused illness to these people?
Well, in the absence of germ theory would be something that comes much later in the 19th century. It was believed that illness was caused by bad air, essentially. If somebody was ill, they rotting vegetables or rotting, animal carcasses would cause that. It was not germs, and it certainly was not the fact that I cough on you. I'm sending illness your way. I'm sending bad air your way. Illness was also understood to be an imbalance of what they called the humors, these vital fluids that were both at once fluids and then also these notions of energy and attributes of, there were four of them, phlegm, bile, black bile, and blood. And so if I were healthy, those attributes, those humors would be in balance, and if I were not healthy, they would be out of whack. Now, they could be offset by nutrition. That would be one way that you could put your body back in balance. And then, of course, they could be more quickly offset or more quickly cured by what we all know about early medicine, by bloodletting and leeches.
And this kind of leads into the story. At that time, what Harvey had just began, had understood that the blood now circulates and is not, before that it was thought that blood was, that it just made itself and stayed in the body and dissipated. And I think as heat at times people thought, and that's another reason why bloodletting would let off some of that, the fever associated
exactly.
with it.
Exactly.
So it was a time when the understanding of the circulation of the blood was just beginning to be appreciated.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, they spent millennia thinking that the best way to cure disease was to let blood out. And circulation in 16, the discovery of circulation by William Harvey in 1628 was remarkable in the sense that it sparked this idea of, well, maybe blood behaves differently than we understood it. In the past, before Harvey, it was believed that blood was produced in the digestive system. So what we ate was concocted, was the word, in the stomach, moved to the liver, where it was purified into the red force, the red life force of blood, and it would make a one-way trip up to the heart, where it was burned off, and that would be what provided the heat of the body and the energy for the body. And that's why, of course, they wanted to do bloodletting, especially when somebody had a fever. It meant that you had too much blood, there was too much blood going into the furnace of the heart, and it was getting burned off too quickly, therefore you had a fever, so the best way to take care of that was to let the blood out of the body. And circulation changed, not the humors. Humors would continue into the 19th century, and it certainly didn't change bloodletting. That also continued well into the 19th century. But what it did do is change exactly the way we understood how blood was produced and how the blood moved through the body, which is what was the first part, the first chapter, if you will, of the history of transfusion itself, is we needed to have that sea change in thinking when it came to how blood was produced and how it moved through the body.
And the other it's kind of natural history break coming up to the idea that transfusions might be useful was the idea that perhaps they were thinking back then, and I think it was Christopher Wren as well as, if I'm right, Harvey, were thinking, well, why don't we put things in these blood vessels of various animals? And there was a lot of dissection going on at that time, and it was a pretty popular thing from what I can understand, not necessarily human, well, some human dissection, but they were using animals. So the next thing before you got to blood was trying to see, well, what happens when you put various things in the bloodstream of animals, which I thought were fascinating, but a natural, I guess, progression of people moving towards then trying to transfuse blood between animals and humans and humans and humans.
Yeah, you have it exactly right. Is Christopher Wren, we have a tendency to look at Christopher Wren as the great architect of London, right? He was actually in the 1650s with Thomas Willis, whom we associate with, of course, the Circle of Willis and neurology. Willis and Wren, along with others in Oxford in England, were actually putting Harvey's theories to the test. Because, of course, if Harvey was right that blood circulated through the body and it was not burned off by the heart, then you would see a lasting impact of whatever you put into the veins of, in this case, an animal. If Harvey was wrong, then whatever you would put in the veins of an animal, be it opium, beer, wine, milk, water, they put all different types of things into the veins of these animals. If Harvey was not right and the heart was a furnace, then the foreign liquor, which is what they called it, would be burned off immediately, right? Mm-hmm. And what they found, what Wren and Willis found out, is that they were putting opium in the veins and arteries of dogs, and the dogs became quickly drugged or died nearly immediately because the foreign fluid was moving and recycling and moving back through again the organism, which made them think, you know, Harvey is entirely right. Because we have to keep in mind is it makes perfect sense to us that blood circulates. In fact, nobody questions that now. But Harvey's theory was just that. It was a theory in the late 1620s that would take nearly 30 to 40 years for people to explore, test, retest, to be able to say, yes, this is indeed a fact. Blood circulates.
Remind our listeners, once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and my guest today is Dr. Holly Tucker. She's recently written a book called Blood Work, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. And we're discussing the history of science and the history of this use of blood transfusions and trying to gain some lessons from this wonderful, wonderful book. And it has another part of it, which is a tale of a murder, which makes it even more intriguing to read. Much more was going on. Whoops, let me forget our number here. If you got comments, is 554-8433, 550-8433. If you've got questions or comments, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. In the midst of this, there was a bigger thing going on, and that's that whole scientific revolution where there was a lot of ideas being turned over, and this idea of testing and empiricism was developing, and it certainly brought us a long way since. Could you also just frame that aspect of what was happening, not only in medicine but in the astronomy and how we look at the Earth and so forth in a bigger sense, but as we begin to talk about the book a little bit more?
Yeah, in fact, you know, beginning in the Renaissance in the 16th century, people began taking a look at the works of the ancients. And these works, of course, were considered to be fact, and in fact, it was, in a way, sacrilege to question the ancients. And by ancients, you know, I'm talking about Aristotle, Plato, Hippocrates, Galen, Avicenna. And by the time you get to the Renaissance, people like Leonardo da Vinci, other people like Andreas Vesalius, the great anatomist of the 16th century who was opening up human bodies and trying to see if those structures that Galen from the second century AD, whether or not he had it right. Now, Galen had never opened up a human body. All he did is dissected animals, and from there he made equivalences. And what Vesalius found in the 16th century is many of those structures just were not right as they were described by Galen. So there had been a long line of questioning of tradition by the time you get to the 17th century, beginning in the Renaissance. Then certain theorists, certain philosophers, such as René Descartes, enter the stage. René Descartes, the great I think, therefore I am philosopher, had a way of understanding his relationship to tradition that broke entirely with what had gone before. Descartes wonders, how do I know what is true? And how can I be sure that those scholars that history has been using for centuries have it right? What if I started with a clean slate and I take only, instead of saying it must be so because it's always been, what if I begin doing tests? What if I take a problem, I divide it into its smallest of parts, I collect experiences and observations, and I go back and I make sure that my data are clean, And from there, only from observation, do I come to any type of statement that I believe to be true about the natural world. Now, this is what we associate with the scientific method. In fact, Rene Descartes is in many ways, and so is Bacon, Roger Bacon, initiators of how we do our science now. And so as natural philosophers, and that's what scientists were called in the 17th and 18th century, as natural philosophers were changing their methods, they were seeing new things. They were looking at the skies differently. They were looking at human bodies differently. They were looking at, I mean, this is a great period of invention. We see some of the first calculators, rudimentary, of course. We see the first studies of hydraulics. We see new ways of understanding stars and planets and moons. So blood transfusion, in fact, I've been finding and thinking through blood transfusion is every single time we come to a moment of revolution, whether it's scientific, medical, or technological, blood is always there, right? Because blood is the life force. Blood is what, you know, one of the fundamental things about being a living organism. And so, of course, if you're going to be questioning the sky, you know, the heavens themselves, you've got to question, you know, man's position in the heavens themselves, and you have to think about the very fluids that are coursing through our body, and of course, blood is the fluid, as they say in French, par excellence, the most, you know, noble of fluids in our body. So I'm not surprised that the 17th century during the scientific revolution would look at blood in new ways and even begin the radical idea of putting blood in other organisms where they had spent so much time taking it out.
Tell us then, I guess that kind of brings us up to the book itself where it talks about some of the research that's going on in Paris and in London and how that goes back and forth and the characters involved. Would you mind telling us a little bit about the book? And maybe we should at some point talk about how you got interested in this particular aspect of the scientific revolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I came at it from two angles. The first is the more historical angle. France and England, you know, during this moment of dramatic rethinking of what it means to be human, what it means to do science, and what it means to interpret the natural world, nations are in the process of being built. And science became the greatest feather in a nation's cap at the same time that these same countries were fighting with one another on the battlefield. They were also fighting it out in their what we would understand to be rudimentary laboratories, but still cutting-edge laboratories at the same time, to be able to see which country, be it France or England primarily, would be able to win. I often call it the earliest equivalent of a space race. Mm-hmm. Who would be able to unlock nature's mysteries first? So there were some really bitter and, cutthroat competitions going on between the English and the French when it came to blood. And the English, with Harvey and Wren and Willis and later on Richard Lower and Robert Boyle, they were winning the race. And it's very interesting that the French came into the race late, but they were the ones who won the battle for the first blood transfusion in humans.
Mm-hmm. And you lead us in this, in your book, the blood work, to that beginning of human-to-human transfusion as part of this space race.
Absolutely. In fact, the English were all over the idea of blood transfusion, and they were so very close to performing the first human blood transfusion, so animal to human. We can talk maybe later about why animals and not humans, but they were so close to performing the first experiment in humans, but then something got in the way. In fact, two somethings got in the way. A horrific plague, the bubonic plague, hit London and decimated nearly half of the London population, and just about the time that Londoners were coming back, those who survived from the countryside after they had fled the capital city, London was decimated then by fire. So science, in many ways, slowed down substantially, if not ceased to exist, over the 18 months or so that London was dealing with horrific disasters. And this gave the French an opportunity to think through blood. Now, the Paris School of Medicine, which held the most elite center for medical practice in France, was very much against the whole idea of blood transfusion because they were very much against the idea of circulation. The most powerful medical men of the 17th century in France thought that the English were lying. They were radical Protestants. They had no business writing the rules of medicine that had been laid down centuries earlier by the ancients. And they still reluctantly went in and performed a good number of blood transfusion experiments on animals in the King's Library. And nearly all of them failed. And they were happy about that because they wanted to be able to prove that the English were liars, mm-hmm. that there was no such thing as a possible blood transfusion, nor was it possible to do give blood circulation any credence. Now, we know that how survival or any the idea of blood transfusion reactions is dependent on three variables. The first is how fast the blood goes in, the second is how much, and the third is whether there's been previous exposure. Now, many of these animals for the English and later on in the human experiments in the French, there wasn't the patients or the animal subjects didn't die because they were using really rudimentary quills that they linked from one to another. So that meant the blood didn't go in very fast. They didn't know about anticoagulants, so the blood clotted. So not much got into it. And for the English, they were not reusing their dogs. The French, however, were reusing their dogs, which meant that the dogs more frequently died, mm-hmm. which told the French and the medical elite that, yep, the English are liars and this is not possible. But what they didn't count on is that there would be a renegade physician who was not trained at the University of Paris. He was actually trained in the south of France, the radical rebel school that took more Protestants than Catholics and that believed in strange things like Paracelsian medicine and chemical medicine, that this young doctor from the south of France would come up to Paris and he would scoop them all. He would do the first human blood transfusion.
And the book is the story of this ambitious young doctor from the wrong side of the track, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, essentially, where I went to school, there was always the other rival school, and that's where all the dummies went. That's where all they did was drink, and in this case, it's the Montpellier students. All they did was drink, cavort with prostitutes, and ask dumb questions like, "What's the meaning of life?" And that's pretty much how this one physician was seen as sort of the dummy of medicine, and it just outraged, the most notable physicians of Paris that he not only was doing blood transfusions, he was doing them publicly. In fact, many of his first transfusions were on the banks of the Seine. And basically, it was a carnival-like atmosphere. It was like, come one, come all, see me transfuse one mangy dog with the blood of a lively, sprightly pup and see the transfusion that will, transformation that will occur. And he was doing that. If any of your listeners have been to Paris, if you're standing right in front of the Saint-Michel fountain in the Latin Quarter, and you turn right and look toward the Louvre, you're on the left bank, it would have been pretty much right at your feet where they were doing these famous animal-to-animal blood transfusions. And so when he had great success with that, he thought that he would make an even bigger name for himself and transfuse his first human.
And this was a time, it was an exciting time for science in that the public was, from what I gather, just drawn to this, all these experiments, looking through telescopes, looking at these transfusions, looking at dissections publicly. It was an exciting time for science in the regard, in the sense that it drew the public imagination and interest, maybe much more differently than it does today, perhaps.
Yeah, It drew the elite public's interest because they had access to the books in which these books and newspapers in which these experiments were being described. They had access to language, right? Because still, major percentage. I think it's I've read somewhere like 90% of the public was more or less illiterate at this time, and also. They could buy things like the little tiny. You know, I always thought that early microscopes were something like we would see in labs now, right? You know, or I imagine them to sit, you know, maybe 2 or 3 feet high, and they would have a candle, and you can look into them. Yeah, that's how later microscopes were. But the very, very first ones, in fact, what Leeuwenhoek, the famous Dutch microscopist, was using, was very, very small. In fact, it's perhaps a little bit more powerful than a magnifying glass, but not much more so. And you could buy these magnifying glasses that you could slip in your pocket, and you could go to dinners, these elite dinners in very nice areas of Paris, and you could do these party games with your friends. You could slip the microscope out, and you might go and meet with one of the microscopists who set up shop in the King's Garden and sold preparations of animal flesh or plants, right? And you could show off your samples at the dinner table. That was a part that just really surprised me is the material culture of this. Is just how accessible for some this equipment was. Now, it was also a display of wealth. Right, for you to be able to buy the latest wrist sundial, they were still using sundials on their wrists to tell time, or to be able to buy, you know, the most cutting edge microscope, or even one of the things that would have been extraordinarily expensive, even for the richest of families, one of the first table clocks, wind up tablecloths. That was a display of your status. So not surprisingly, a lot of Parisianers in the more wealthy areas, like the Marais in Paris, would have these telescopes sitting on tops of their roofs. In fact, one historian describes them as like guns jutting off of each of the buildings, because they were party games and they were displays of wealth. And what better way to display your wealth than to be able to have a really beautiful handcrafted telescope on the roof of your home?
Fascinating. I want to continue a little bit more understanding the frame of reference for the book, and we'll talk about the book more, but we need to take our usual break at this time. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. Our local number, if you have questions or comments, is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue to talk with Dr. Holly Tucker of Vanderbilt University and the author of Blood Work, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guest is Dr. Holly Tucker, who's joining us from Nashville by telephone. She's the author of Blood Work, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. It's a narrative history of the 17th century exploration of blood transfusions. Up to this point, we've been kind of filling in the background of the times of the scientific revolution and what has led up to the interest in blood transfusions, starting with animals and progressing to humans, which is really the story of her book, Blood Work, which is not only a fascinating history, but also brings up a wonderful mystery as well. I want to recommend the book to everyone who is interested in science or the history. It gives a wonderful portrait of what the beginnings of the scientific revolution was like on a day-to-day basis. If you have questions or comments today, we'll be with you another 30 minutes or, 25 minutes or so. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our regular number, 550-8433. And our outside toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 locally, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we won't be able to take phone calls or answer emails at that time. Dr. Tucker, what else was going on at the time that makes us really want to understand why history was so important? I guess the real question I am trying to ask is why do we need to study history at all? What are the lessons? And in particular, what have you gathered? You've already kind of hinted at some of the things that you learned from writing the book and researching the book, To me, when I read it, I just find fascinating corollaries with how we think about science and technology today, and I can place myself back in the same period of time and thinking the same way. People kind of have the same kinds of thoughts.
Well, I think you've mentioned it as well, is that there's a murder in this book. And specifically, once the French transfusionist Jean-Baptiste Denis begins his human trials, he begins transfusing humans with sheep's blood and also cow's blood. And the first couple of transfusions go well to the extent that the patients don't die. But the third one, he transfuses a mentally ill man who runs around the streets of Paris naked, absolutely incoherent and screaming, is that by the third time he transfuses this patient, the patient dies. Now, I'm going to get to this question of, what's the modern relevance of this through the murder. When I was researching early blood transfusions, one thing stood out to me is that the transfusionist was called up on murder charges for having killed his patient. And there was a huge series of trials around this perceived murder. And then the courts decide, no, there was no murder, but blood transfusion itself must be stopped. In fact, it cannot continue without the express approval of the Paris Faculty of Medicine. Now, we know that the Paris Faculty of Medicine found blood transfusion disgusting, and we also know that it didn't even believe in circulation, so they were never going to let another blood transfusion be continued. And historians have always said, well, it's a good thing that blood transfusion was stopped because they didn't know about anesthesia, they didn't know about antisepsis, and they did not know about blood types. Many lives would have been lost, and that's probably very, very true. But what was typically ignored in the treatment of this is that the court also said there was murder. The transfusionist didn't do it. Somebody else did, and they had the help of a number of physicians. And so for the modern aspects of this, and what really the other thing that I wanted to do in this book is, one, is to throw myself back into this time period and get a real sense. It sounds like you and I both share this fascination for what it meant to do science and what it meant to do medicine and what it meant to live in the past. But I really wanted to get at the question is, what is it about blood transfusion that was considered so scary and so dangerous that several physicians would have resorted to murder to kill a patient? And that's, I think, where the modern resonance of this book comes in, is that in any time, in any period, research is moving questions forward that society may not be all that open to, right?
Like genetically modified foods.
Yeah, I think that would be one. Another one that Well, actually, to be very honest with you, I wasn't sure how I was going to present this research. I thought maybe I would write it as a sort of standard academic article or an academic monograph. And it was only when I was listening to a speech by George W. Bush in 2006. It was a State of the Union address, and he really surprised the medical and the scientific community by saying, he essentially was calling for a ban on interspecies research and human embryological stem cell research, and called for legislation that would prohibit human-animal hybrids, is what he called them. And I thought it was fascinating to me as listening to my colleagues who work in medical research and biomedical research, and then also watching what was happening in the public domain. You know, the whole idea that there are some mad scientists out there that will create, you know, humans that bark. And it made me really start to wonder, well, gosh, wasn't there similar fears around blood transfusion? Because some physicians in Paris particularly were very scared that they were going to be creating, that by putting animal blood into humans, they would be creating new species. Now, for as ridiculous as that sounds to us, it was scary enough for them to resort to murder, right?
Sure. Yeah, and there's unfortunately been murders committed in the realm of medicine, in the idea that various kinds of abortions might not be the right thing to do. Now, I'm not trying to take sides here. I'm just trying to make the parallels that the emotions can run so high then, and they can run so high today, that it can drive people to do things that otherwise you would not think possible.
Well, and to get to the what you said about not taking sides, that's precisely my role. In fact, I've written this book in such a, I hope I'd be interested in hearing from your listeners, in a balanced way that is not about taking sides, but rather using the past and controversies between science and society in the past as a way to start a discussion that is measured and respectful, and in a type of discussion that we don't see, I think, enough in the United States. You know, we have a tendency now to see, you know, people shouting at one another on TV. Is by taking the story of tensions between science and society into the past, that gives us a safer space. And it is true, is that people do, you know, no matter what side you're on the question, do feel so strongly about, you know, the relationship is between science and how we understand what it means to be human, right? When someone becomes a human, is it at conception or is it later, right? Mm-hmm. What happens if you move human neurological stem cells, cells into mice brains, right?
Right?
What does that do to the boundaries of humanness? People feel very strongly about it, and they felt strongly about it too in the 17th century, to such a degree that, you know, these physicians, and I spent several years trying to figure out the identity of these guys, and I thought for sure that there was that link between, you know, interspecies fears and blood transfusion, and then the eventual murderers. I had a hard time finding the links until finally I stumbled on a letter by a lawyer written at Parliament, which is the equivalent of the French Supreme Court, saying, "The transfusionist Jean-Baptiste Denis has every reason to fear for his life. These physicians have killed before, and they are willing to kill again." And he named them. Finally, I had names. And once I started to go into the letters and treatises of these physicians, it was clear to me these were men who felt deeply that their role was to protect humanity and to protect it from science and to make sure that science didn't do untold damage to the human species. Now, they also, in one case specifically, said it's my role to, you know, a doctor to be able to do this can kill. And, you know, it pretty much admits the murder. And I thought, you know, that their intentions are noble, perhaps. their actions, not so much so. But one thing that is absolutely certain is they believed truly in their cause. And once I had the names of these guys, it was clear they were sort of sitting out there in plain sight, because in this case I would call them taking more vigilante types of behaviors, and vigilantes are rarely shy in this
mm-hmm.
case.
Mm-hmm.
But it has been fun and interesting and really humbling to have discussions around this book and this case with whole varieties of people, and realize that we can have these open discussions. And sometimes the past gives us that safe space to do it.
There are other parallels, a number of other parallels to me. I mean, the one that you mentioned about the space race, I frankly just didn't notice in the book, but your description is right. England and France were having wars at the same time, so the science was like a space race, and part of that was the blood transfusion. But there was also the parallel of misinterpretation of the experimental data that the French did, because just the technique was wrong. It wasn't that what was, you know, happening was necessarily wrong. They may have found it for a different reason later, but their experiments were wrong, but just because their techniques were different, and they came up with the wrong conclusion, and so those kind of things continue. And another somewhat similar parallel to me is I think they were in the middle of a huge change in how the world was being looked at. That change has really brought us a long way. There's some wonderful bits of information and suggestion that at least at some time about the time of the scientific revolution, our world population has exploded. At the same time, we've all become healthier and wealthier, and it seems to be that the use of the scientific method as a way to understand what's real was coming out of there at that time, and yet people, even scientists, were scared of it. And today we have a lot of resistance against this methodology, even within the academics at times. Are those parallels worth getting into as well?
Yeah, I think you say very, very, very well is that the world was changing, and many of the changes that were taking place have a direct bearing on how we live our lives today, the scientific method, right? As well as the idea, Descartes, some of the reason why they could imagine these animal-to-human experiments is because, again, of René Descartes, the father of the scientific method, I think, therefore I am. Descartes held that, and it was a radical notion, is that there's really no difference between animals and humans. We're all machines. Our bodies are machines. The only thing that differentiates us from animals is that we can think, we can speak, we can reason, and we have a soul. And all of those attributes are not part of the body. So, to do these transfusions from animals to humans would be no different than changing the oil in your car, because we're all machines. And that idea of what we call Cartesian dualism really persists today, because in medical practice, we do have an idea that, in certain circles, that the body is a machine for us to fix, right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of ideas and thoughts and feelings may not be all that relevant as we're trying to, put order to a machine that is not working or that's broken. And so the ways that we imagine the body and the way that we treat the body is truly, for better or for worse, a legacy of the scientific revolution. But at the same time, in the scientific revolution, I should say, we can't consider it to be a radical break, the pre-modern versus the modern. Because just as the whole idea of astronomy and astrology and alchemy and chemistry, there was no such break. Is that, you probably noticed in this book, just for as much as we would recognize traces of modern science in the scientific revolution, where there are tons of superstitions that I discuss.
Right.
Yeah.
I think, and to me, that's another parallel, that we still have superstitions and beliefs, and it's often because we don't understand the way things really are underneath them. They thought then that comets, and I'll let you talk about how the comets may have that were seen in England at that time may have portended the onset of another plague and so forth. But once we understand what's really going on, then witchcraft doesn't make sense anymore, and comets don't portend a next plague and so forth. So there's, again, there's still those beliefs that we all have today that because we don't quite understand how something really works.
Right, and I think it's great to hear a physician like you is say this. We want our medicine and we want our science to tell us the truth and only the truth, right? Nothing right. but the truth. But the fact of the matter is that we have to be humble enough to recognize that there are still so many things that we don't understand and so many things that we are likely just getting really wrong. Or even in our practices, we're doing the best we can with the tools that we have right now. I can't help but think, you know, for any of us who have had friends or have gone through this ourselves, who've gone through, for example, chemotherapy and treatment for cancer, it's a brutal therapy. It's very brutal. It's the best, in many cases, that we can do right now that's changing very quickly. But how are people going to look at us 50 years from now, 100 years from now? And understand that we're basically poisoning our bodies to get rid of, you know, these fast-growing cells. Is people will look back at us in many of the same ways that we're looking back at the 17th century, you know, both horror, giggling, hopefully generosity, and hopefully we'll merit that generosity that we did our very best under the circumstances and what we knew.
Are we going through a scientific revolution, and maybe that's not the right way to say it, to the same degree as it was happening in the 16th, 17th century Europe, maybe on a worldwide basis? I mean, we have far, far more scientists now than we've ever had, and I'm sure people at the time didn't recognize what was happening in Europe. Those people who live there, just like maybe we don't appreciate the dynamic changes that are going on now and need to go on just to continue to have a healthy world and a healthy life and not polluting and feeding the ever-growing populations.
You know, I think every time period probably thinks that it's the exception and that there's something dramatically changing. My sense is absolutely, I mean, if we just look at where we were 10 years ago in regard to technology, right, and communications. But one of the things I'm fond of saying is that, you know, when you're in a given worldview, you don't really know much else. And the paradigm in which we're living necessarily dictates the questions that we can ask. And because we're only able to ask certain questions, that dictates the answers that we get, right? And we don't really know what other questions we could be answering and asking because all we know is what we're able to ask. And I use with my students at the undergraduate level, I use the example of September 11th. I know that I thought about the world so very differently on September 10th than I did on September 11th. Certain questions and certain fears that we all could have been having, you know, it was just a matter of a day, we couldn't conceptualize because we were in one paradigm and things shifted dramatically. Now we look at the world so very differently. Just think about those days when you could bring your family members into the airport and say goodbye to them at the gate. You know, so many things changed so quickly, and I sense that something big is happening. In this moment, I'm not really sure what it is and how it's going to, you know, how it's going to turn out. And I do think that the natural philosophers, the scientists in the 17th century, knew that big things were happening, but they really didn't know the full impact of their work until they didn't know it because they, you know, were dead by then. But we're now just trying to dig through and make sense of what was happening then.
It was a time where everything was kind of, I mean, I'm sure you've heard this before, and I may be over, lots of things were being overthrown. The earth was no longer the center of the universe. You know, blood circulated through the heart. Things that had been for 2,000 years were accepted. There was religious transformations. There was a lot going on in a couple of hundred years there. You know, people like Descartes and Bacon were beginning to formalize how to think about really understanding what's real and what's not, which led to this scientific method, as you said. So, I don't know. To me, it's an extremely dynamic period, and it would seem like when you're in the middle of it, it'd be very, very hard to understand. But it was certainly fascinating, and your book, which is just a small part of it, captures all of that, and yet it has a lot of good medicine, a lot of interesting science, a lot of good human nature, a lot of parallels with us. So I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to talk to you about it. You used that example about Harvey and how his point of view would not have been the same 50 years before he did that, because no one understood valves and different things about how was present. But I'm sorry, go ahead and make some comments. I interrupted.
Oh no! It's always a thrill to talk to other people who enjoy these stories. They are rich, they're dynamic, they're confusing sometimes, and then you just shake your head. Harvey would dissect family members, not many, one or two, but other colleagues on his big dining room table. And Jean-Baptiste Denis, the transfusionist, he was a newlywed. I can only imagine what his wife thought about all these dogs, you know, being transfused in their living room. So there are sometimes when you look at the big questions and you realize that you're basically walking in the footsteps of these very great thinkers. But then at the same time, you look and there's a certain strangeness that borders on being so odd as to be very humorous, right? The very idea that, you know, when in cases of, and it wouldn't be humorous if it were happening to one of us, of course, but during the Plague of London, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, illness was caused by bad air, miasma is what they called, is that there were these men that walked around with plague suits, and they looked something like, how would you describe them? Ducks, I guess, or birds. And they would set everything on fire, because that was the only way to get rid of the disease, was to get rid of the bad air. And you look at these outfits and you think about, you know, they were doing their best, but think about all the destruction they caused for the common good, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people, as I understand, were locked in their own houses if there'd been a case, or they thought there was a case, and clearly human nature was, I need to get out and get some food and do some things, so that didn't work so well. It was, the plague is another fascinating story.
Well, and the idea, I love even the languages we use, to be double-crossed. Right. That comes from the plague, is that people would move from house to house, and they would put a cross on the house.
Oh, yeah.
and then double, and then put another line across it to indicate that there's plague in this house, and God be with this family. And so the whole idea is to be double-crossed. You did not want your house to be double-crossed, because that indicated to the entire world that disease was within, and that you didn't have much hope at survival. So, of course, we don't even want to be double-crossed now.
So we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. I guess the last thing I would be personally interested in is how you did the research. How many of it sounds like there's a lot of personal letters, documents that are very available, especially if you can read French, as you can. It would seem fascinating to do that in the amount of time, however, it would take to really put this whole story together, as you did so wonderfully in your book.
Well, the nice thing, the nice thing about doing what I'm doing is I get to make arguments that I need to travel to London, I need to spend summers in Paris to be able to work in the collections. And that is true to a large degree when you're doing this level of research. But for I imagine you might be asking that question for your listeners, if you know, if they really wanted to dig in and take a look at some of these letters, some of these images. There are a couple of resources that I would recommend. If they go to Google and type in welcome, W-E-L-L-C-O-M-E, images, the Welcome Library in London has an extraordinary set of hundreds, if not thousands of images of medicine and history. And you can type in words like transfusion, you can type in words like diabetes, anything you can imagine, you can take a look at these historical images. The National Library of Medicine, if you type in NLM images, you can do the same in American collections. And the nice thing is you can get onto these full-text databases. There's the Gutenberg Project, where you can take a look at accounts of the plague, and also to the British Library. They have digitized full-length text. So you don't have to be a historian to be able to do just, you know, read through and take a look at images from the periods. Now, to get into the deep type of level for a book like this, it does help to have archival research experience. But for me, a lot of bringing the past alive is about looking at the maps, looking at the images, reading newspapers from the period to get a sense of, you know, again, what it meant to live in the 1660s.
Well, I really want to express my gratitude for you taking the time today, and really strongly recommend that it's a great read. It's a wonderful story. It took a lot of time and effort, and it's obviously that you're a very good writer as well. Holly, I really have appreciated you taking the time.
Oh, it was my treat. It was my treat. Thank you again for giving me a chance to talk about the book.
All right. Well, hope we get to read another book along the same lines.
One's coming.
Okay, good. You have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Holly Tucker, author of Blood Work, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. I'd strongly recommend that to anyone who's interested just in a great historical perspective of the 17th century, particularly if you're interested in medicine or blood transfusions or just how the scientific method came about. Next week, next week, I want to remind everybody you can also join this conversation if you would like to on Facebook. Our new website there is alaskapublic.org. If you just go to Facebook, you can join the conversation and continue it at that place. And you can join us next week on Monday afternoon, December 12th. When the next edition of Line One, Your Health Connection, will be available, we'll be talking with Dr. Elizabeth Morgan at that time. Dr. Morgan is an expert locally on glaucoma. Glaucoma is a disease that affects 1 million people in the United States who do not know they have it, and it is a common cause of blindness. I want to remind our listeners as well that Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack graciously is our web editor and audio engineer. I'd like to thank all of those who listened today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.